May it please the court, Gregory Joseph for the plaintiff appellants, the plaintiff's counsel appellants. Your honors, the fundamental question that this appeal raises is what standards do we hold lawyers to? We expect lawyers to read the rules and the law. We expect them to act in accordance with a reasonable interpretation of the rules and the law, an interpretation that is plausible, that is colorable, and is not baseless. That is the standard for sanctions. It isn't changed by the fact that the district court relied on the improper purpose clause of Rule 11 because the court made it very clear that that was a consequence of his finding objectively unreasonable my client's interpretation of Rule 23E, which is supported by every major treatise in the Tenth Circuit, the only circuit that's spoken on it, and Rule 41, in which he applied precedent to a Rule 41A1 dismissal, which has never previously been applied by this court to that standard, and which every other circuit that's considered the issue does not apply.
Mr. Joseph, you agree then with where you started, that there's no question about the judge's authority, jurisdiction, power here?
Yes, under Cooter and Gell, we're not challenging the court's ability to address the sanctions
issue. And even years later, a judge could look at an order and see if it was fraudulent, bribery, improper purpose, all that kind of stuff.
Yes, Your Honor.
Proceed.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. I want to focus first on the Rule 23E issue because that is the foundation of the settlement, of the sanction. The court said specifically that the improper purpose was evading federal review. It says that 11 times in its opinions in order to show cause. And his conclusion about evading federal review depends entirely on his interpretation of Rule 23E. His conclusion that the 2003 amendment to Rule 23E, which inserted the word certified to make it clear that it only applied to certified class actions, did not divest the court of the prior authority it had before that word was inserted to adjudicate and approve any dismissal or settlement of any uncertified class action.
Did the court at all discuss the ramification of the difference between a certified class and one that hadn't been certified?
It did not, Your Honor, because the focus here was on the uncertified settlement of the uncertified class. And what he said was that if our interpretation were correct, as Rule 23E, then he said, and this is a quote, it would necessitate a reexamination of whether a Rule 11 violation occurred at all. He says that at page 40 of the addendum. So the Rule 23E issue is the crux of this case. And our interpretation of Rule 23 had to be plausible, had to be colorable, and it had to be reasonable.
Well, counsel, you agree 23E doesn't say anything about an uncertified class.
Correct, but it did before. Mm-hmm. But here's what it said before. Before, the rule said, a class action shall not be dismissed or compromised without approval of the court. That's the old rule. And this court in Crawford said that means certified or uncertified. In 2001, the advisory committee put out a draft of the new rule that would become 23E, and it preserved that rule. It was going to say it would apply certified or uncertified. It changed it, and it changed it so that the final rule inserted the word certified, so it says the claims, issues, or defenses of a certified class may be settled, voluntarily dismissed, or compromised only with the court's approval. And the advisory committee note.
Well, counsel, I looked at your page 40.
Yeah.
And he's talking about jurisdiction there. He says the parties some way fraudulently messed around with this to divest the court of jurisdiction. Now, did they divest the court of jurisdiction?
I'm sorry, maybe it's page 41.
Yeah, it's the one you referred to.
I'm sorry.
Page 40 of the addendum.
Hold on, I've got it right here.
Well, no, I got somebody else's addendum, but I think it's the same addendum.
What he says is an interpretation.
It's page 8 of his order.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
He says an interpretation would divest the court of jurisdiction.
Correct.
Now, how did the parties divest the court of jurisdiction?
Your Honor, he looked at a couple of diversity cases in the Supreme Court, and he said, well, once you've got diversity jurisdiction, subsequent events can't divest the court of jurisdiction, but Rule 23E never conferred jurisdiction, so it never divested.
Now, wait. When they filed their lawsuit, they got jurisdiction.
Correct.
Right, yeah. But and it was in federal court. Go ahead.
That's true, Your Honor, but there was no divestiture of jurisdiction. By any settlement would, in that sense, divest the court of jurisdiction. The cases he relies on for jurisdiction simply say that if you have diversity at the beginning, you can't change that by moving. You can't change the amount in controversy.
Well, you and I thought this wasn't about jurisdiction. Why does the district court think it's about jurisdiction?
He says that that supports his interpretation of Rule 23E, that if you were to interpret Rule 23E the way Moores and Wright and Miller interpret it, that would lead to an abrogation of the bedrock principle that once a court has jurisdiction, it can't be divested. Your Honor, it's, with all respect, a misguided interpretation because the court had jurisdiction of the case. The question was whether its approval of a dismissal of the case was required. That's purely a rule matter. It's not a jurisdictional matter. And the authorities are not equivocal about this and how to interpret this rule. And this is the basis on which my clients acted. This is what Wright and Miller says about the 2003 amendments, quote, they explicitly limit the court approval requirement to settlements of claims, issues, or defenses of a certified class. And this is what Moore says. The 2003 amendments to Rule 23E intentionally limit the court's supervisory powers over dismissals and voluntary settlements to class actions in which a class has been certified. The Tenth Circuit said the same thing in Lucero. This was not an idiosyncratic view of the law that my clients took, something sanctionable. This was the generally accepted view of the law, and it's the predicate to the sanction, because if in fact there was no authority in the district court, the right to approve or disapprove the settlement of an uncertified class, then nobody was evading federal review. In fact, Rule 23E in 2003 had taken away federal review. It was not a sanctionable act. You know, every other judge in Arkansas that was faced with this, and four federal judges were presented with exactly the same procedure, acquiesced in it knowingly. They were told that a settlement was proceeding in state court, and they deferred.
This judge wasn't told, right?
He wasn't told.
He went through the clerk's office, a whiz-bang deal, right?
It's true, but that was also true in the Vinson case before Judge Wilson. He wasn't told in advance. Nobody thought it was necessary, and Judge Wilson Judge Wilson put in a dismissal with prejudice, so they called and said, we're proceeding in state court. Judge Wilson turned it into a dismissal without prejudice. So that was fully knowing. So when it's been countenanced by other judges, there was no reason to believe, when you look at Rule 23E that doesn't require advance notice, that advance notice would be something that the court would take offense at not having. But there was no lack of candor.
Counselor, what of the court's concern for the waste of judicial resources to have this process proceed in federal court only to be dismissed after the use of time and talent of resources and simply to proceed with a settlement?
Your Honor, very little had happened in federal court. A motion had been filed for judgment on the pleadings, which was never adjudicated, never responded to, because immediately they said, we're working on a settlement. For over a year, the case was stayed to allow Judge Lane Phillips, former federal judge, to mediate a settlement. So very little was actually done.
Well, don't you think the judge is more upset about the big threat of the hammer of federal court here? I think that's what he's getting at, isn't it?
Definitely.
You played the federal court four different ways.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That you played, it's a slang term for exploiting, that you exploited your clients, not you, Mr. Joseph, that your clients exploited the federal court by the way you got this done.
Well, my clients filed in state court. My clients didn't want to be in federal court to begin with.
Yeah, but once they got there, go ahead.
No, it's true. But they were very candid with the court for over a year that they were working on a settlement. And when they had a settlement, they told the court they had a settlement. The court didn't inquire about the settlement, and the case was dismissed. Now, it's true that prior to 2003, it would have gone to this judge. That was changed in 2003. And if your honors were to decide that, unlike the Tenth Circuit, unlike Moores and Wright and Miller, maybe Rule 23E, even though it says certified, means certified and uncertified, whatever the court decides shouldn't be retroactively applied, because the standard is, was it reasonable what they did? Was the conduct reasonable, colorable, not baseless? And when you have circuit court authority and all major treatises and no contrary authority, it's difficult to say it's sanctionable. It's not sanctionable behavior. And that's why I say the ultimate question is, what standard do you hold lawyers to? And on Rule 23, it's not a close question. And when you turn to Rule 41, and Judge Shepard, you wrote Thatcher. I'm not going to try and say anything more about what it means. You know what it means. But it's been described by this court in the Donner case, in which Your Honor participated as a panelist, as our Rule 41A2 precedent. And it makes sense that it's 41A2 precedent, because when there's an objector, there can be prejudice. And then forum shopping can be prejudicial, and it's a perfectly valid reason to deny a motion to dismiss. But in this case, the parties consented. There was no prejudice. And there's never been a case that has previously applied the limitations of Thatcher and Hammond or 41A2 to 41A1. And we've cited multiple circuits that say there are no forum shopping restrictions on 41A1. The Second Circuit in Wolters, the Fifth Circuit in Beechuck, the
Counsel,
Ninth Circuit in Swedberg.
Proof too much.
Pardon?
There's no proof too much. There surely could be a case where you know, bribery, fraud, bribing the clerk, doing something.
If you look at Your Honor's case, in the 1990 case, this court wrote in Safeguard, they cite an earlier case called Harvey in the Second Circuit, which has said there are no constraints, in which there was like a month-long TRO hearing with evidence, and they said that's too much. All right, so when I say no, I'm saying that that's what these courts are saying, but this court recognized in Safeguard that there could be an extreme case. This was not that case. Nothing had happened in federal court.
But wasn't the district court also concerned about the uncertified class?
It was, Your Honor.
The duty of counsel to the uncertified class, and it seemed to be pretty clear as I read through this that primary reason for this, for the desire to move back to state court, was to make it more difficult for potential class members to object and for their objections to be sustained.
Your Honor, I think that's very true. I would say two things about that. First, this was a decision that the rulemakers made in 2003. It may have been a wrong decision. Counsel here will argue that there should be a requirement that you go through the federal court. That was taken away. Some people, myself included, said, why are we doing this? But that is the law. And secondly, this judge made it very clear he was not sitting in review of the settlement. Page 11 of the addendum says, I did not sit in review. And he discouraged counsel from actually defending it at the hearing of February 18th, 2016. He said, we're not here on the settlement. I don't want to hear about the settlement. So there were no findings that the settlement was improper.
Mr. Joseph, you've got a minute left if you want to reserve it.
I shall, Your Honor. Thanks very much.
All right. Mr. Walsh.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Tom Walsh for the defense counsel below appellants Pruitt, Goldman, and Ackerman, highly respected lawyers who have been held to have violated Rule 11 and abused the judicial process by this district judge.
Now, plaintiff's counsel have not appealed?
Oh yes.
Castleberry, Mustak, Myers?
Well, that's who Mr. Joseph represents.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, proceed.
Right. First, I'd like to mention the issue of jurisdiction because it's out there. This court has never ruled on a case like this whether it is, in fact, appealable. Eight or arguably ten circuits have held that it is appealable even in the absence of a formal sanction. Counsel here has cited the Baker case as perhaps suggesting that this court has held that such a ruling is not appealable. Baker does not so hold.
Well, counsel, here's what worries me about your position. What worries me is we have judges who scold counsel all the time. Is that enough to appeal? How are we going to draw the line, you know, on what you get to appeal? I'm afraid yours is an awfully slippery slope.
It's a formal ruling, a holding that there's a violation of a federal rule of Rule 11 and an abuse of judicial process. Baker was your case. Baker, what was at stake there were critical comments during the course of the trial. And the court said, we can't allow things like that to be appealed because that happens in every trial. But where you have a formal determination, that's the difference,
okay,
even if it falls short.
I'm with you. What are the magic words? Violated Rule 11?
That would do it. A violation of Rule 11. Abuse of judicial process would do it. And he held both.
Those are the two quotes here, right?
He held both in this case, yes. And these lawyers have their reputations at stake. I don't care what he called it. This is a finding of some misdeed, some wrongdoing. And my clients have national practices, which means that from time to time and quite frequently, they're required to file motions for pro hoc vice admission to various state and federal courts around the country. And in the course of that application, they're frequently asked such questions as, have you ever been subject to disciplinary action or the finding of wrongful conduct, something like that. It varies all over the lot. But with this hanging out there, they have a tough decision. Do we have to disclose this? And if so, will it cause us to not be retained or not be allowed to participate in this particular case? So it has real-world consequences, and these people, in our view, have been wrongfully accused of wrongdoing, and they should have an opportunity in this court to vindicate their name.
Let me interrupt you, because I'm confused, as you could tell from the beginning. I thought that formal sanctions were only against five or six attorneys.
Five plaintiff's lawyers were reprimanded. The other plaintiff's lawyers and defense counsel were held to have violated Rule 11 and abused the judicial process, but were not formally sanctioned.
But they did not do it in bad faith, right?
Yes.
Correct. That was the key.
Yes. The bad faith on the plaintiff's side was knowing about Thatcher and not citing it. I mean, that's for Mr. Joseph to argue, but I think that's pretty thin. I'd like to talk about the merits a bit as they relate to our clients, who are differently situated, obviously, from plaintiff's counsel. The plaintiff's counsel at some point have a duty to the class, and the court held it had a duty to the class, but our clients certainly don't have a duty to the class. Our clients have a duty to their client, USAA, in this particular case, and they have a duty to follow the client's instructions. Under Arkansas law of professional responsibility, section 1.2, it says that a lawyer shall abide by a client's decision whether to settle a matter.
But counsel, no lawyer's under an obligation to violate what they understand to be the correct rule of law.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. But this, what was at issue here, was a claims-made settlement. The defense counsel were told by their client that they wanted a claims-made settlement for a number of reasons. Plaintiff's counsel said, we will only agree to a claims-made settlement if it's adjudicated in state court. Our clients were more than happy to stay in federal court. They had removed the case there. They liked the procedures of federal court and actually negotiated to stay there. But when the sine qua non of a claims-made settlement was dictated to be a dismissal and refiling in state court, they were instructed by their client to go along with that, and they didn't have any choice. And there was nothing inappropriate about it. I mean, Rule 41A1 is perfectly clear that the parties may stipulate to a dismissal without prejudice. And this court has held in the Safeguard case, and other courts have held, that once that stipulation is filed, the case is over, and we shall not inquire into the reasons for the dismissal. So that's the way the rule's written, and that's the way our people read it. And six other cases in Arkansas have been settled that way, and the client, USAA, knew that and said, they did it, why can't we do it? And there was no reason why defense counsel would say, we can't do that. You could read the cases, you could read the law, and nobody acting objectively would have said, there's something wrong with this. As I say, the client was aware of these other cases, some of which contained the same type of claims. And since those judges had never raised an objection, never raised a question, and they knew about it, there was no reason to believe that this judge would have any objection to that type of a procedure.
Description of the timing between the other district court cases and this one? How were they in relation?
Well, they were all prior. They're listed in our brief. I don't know exactly
the
timing,
okay.
They were all prior.
And they involved, handy. Otherwise, I'll look it up.
They involved four different Arkansas federal judges, all of whom said this is okay, and counsel says they breached their fiduciary duty by doing that. Well, judge's fiduciary duty doesn't apply in a class action context until he's called upon to review the reasonableness of a certified class settlement. And this judge apparently thought he had some kind of a fiduciary duty just because a putative class had been filed. But until it's certified, he has no responsibility and no authority to disapprove a dismissal that the parties jointly agree to. That's what Rule 41 says. That's what our clients read it to say. They didn't do anything wrong. They didn't act unreasonably. And their reputation should respectfully be vindicated by this court. Thank you very much.
Frank?
(Clears throat) Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Theodore H. Frank for the court-appointed amicus. I think there's a very important distinction to be made here between Rule 11b1 and Rule 11b2. And the question is whether there's an improper purpose, not whether they had a colorable basis for doing what they did, but whether what they did had an improper purpose. And as Judge Easterbrook said in Mars Steele, something can be non-frivolous but still have an improper purpose.
What's the improper purpose?
Here the improper purpose was misleading the court. It was the entire course of conduct of misleading the court and evading the court's review in order to prejudice the absent class members in favor of the defendant and the plaintiff's counsel. And that's on page 34 of the addendum.
So what facts show misleading to the court?
Well, they agreed to a settlement in principle in March, and in April they file a 26F statement with the court that does not mention the settlement, says we're going to get rid of the pending motion to dismiss, and we expect to go to trial in 2016. Now, the court said, I'm not going to find that you deliberately misled me, but you did show a lack of candor there.
Okay, when you use the term court, you mean judge here.
Judge.
Okay, because Rule 41 uses the term court. Do you think it means the institution? That is, the clerk's office or a ministerial task means court in Rule 41.
I think Rule 41A1 does refer to the ministerial task. I agree with that.
How does that affect this whole case?
Well, it doesn't. Cooter and Gell was also a Rule 41 dismissal, and the court retained its jurisdiction to sanctions and behavior that happened before the dismissal. And here the dismissal was part of a course of conduct that, and we just heard from counsel for plaintiff's counsel that the problem with forum shopping is when it prejudices absent party or prejudices parties. And the court found prejudice on page 34, and that's not a finding that they ever challenge. And in the context of 41A1A2, which is, I think, different than 41A1A1, the issue is, are you prejudicing anyone? And when you have absent class members that are actually prejudiced by the dismissal, as the court found.
How do we even know they're going to be class members?
I'm sorry?
How do we even know they're going to be class members? That's another thing that troubles me about this case. You see what I'm saying? At this point, we don't have a class. As you know, sometimes classes are worked. We see in our cases, in the district court cases, they're worked, reworked, CAFA rules, trying to do this, trying to do that.
Well,
how do we even know who we're talking about here?
Well, there is a putative class.
And
contrary to what they say, judges do owe a duty to that. And that's a very big point of Standard Fire versus Nowell's, that you can't let the plaintiff's attorney violate his fiduciary duty to the class by throttling the claims of the class for a jurisdictional purpose.
Does that mean a putative class? Or does that mean a real class?
That absolutely means a putative class because it's at the complaint stage.
Okay.
It's when you're filing the complaint, there's no certified class yet. And here there is a de facto, there wasn't a certified class, but there was a stipulated class in the agreement that was signed before the dismissal, but that nobody told the judge. And all of these other precedents involve cases where the district court was told, hey, there's a parallel state proceeding, we're doing this in state court. There was not a case where the district court had no awareness of what was going on. And
well, Western Arkansas, that's where this is from, isn't it? Can Western Arkansas make a rule that says there'll be no 41A1s unless the judge reviews it?
They can make that rule. And they don't have
do
that
they have
rule
any
here.
Rule like that now?
They do not have a rule like that now.
Now the clerk can do it, huh?
Now the clerk can do it.
Thank you.
But again, the argument is not you made a frivolous dismissal. The argument is you made a dismissal for improper purpose. And the improper purpose is forum shopping to prejudice someone. And in conjunction with everything else that happened and the entire course of conduct, That I think is within the court's discretion.
Okay, I can ask you something.
Please do.
Okay, I think I got it figured out. Mr. Joseph represents people who got a reprimand and people who didn't, right? He's got
that's
both
correct.
Of them?
Yes.
Okay, I've been terribly confused with that. So he's got some that did and some that didn't.
That's correct.
And Mr. Walsh only has a defense counsel. Right?
That's correct.
Okay. Why aren't the defense counsel pretty good shape on this?
They won. So that's a very interesting question.
No, but I mean in terms of this proceeding.
All right, in good shape in terms of...
Yeah, yeah. Because the plaintiff's lawyers are the ones that are messing with the class. They're the ones that have a duty to the defense lawyer doesn't have a duty to the class.
Except to resist it, maybe, or something
like that. Go ahead.
I agree with that, and that's why the defense counsel were in sanctions. They were acting in the interest of their clients.
But should they even have been held to violate Rule 11 and abuse the judicial process? The defense lawyers.
I think that's a poor turn of phrase, but it's not clear
I'm
to
sorry,
me.
That's the judge's finding.
I agree that's the judge's finding. It's not clear to me what it means that you've violated Rule 11 and I'm not sanctioning you.
Means you don't get a reprimand. Reprimands recognized ABA standards as a level of discipline of attorneys.
If the very fact of saying that Rule 11 is a sanction, you have violated Rule 11, is a sanction that's reviewable, then they're absolutely correct. I will concede that.
Address the heart of what I'm trying to say. What did the defense lawyers do wrong?
Given the court's finding that their misleading 26F statement was not in bad faith, it's not clear that they did anything wrong.
What were the... could you take just a moment and enumerate, if there are any, false statements that were made by counsel to the court during the course of this proceeding in the district court?
The court said the 26F statement was misleading. And then at A120 of the appendix, they call the settlement that they did in state court a common fund settlement, which was not true. It was a claims-made settlement. And then that's a distinction they lied again, that gets elided again in the reply brief, where they confuse claims-made settlements, where the defendant keeps any money that is not claimed by the class, with a common fund settlement with a claims process, where the defendant creates a pot of money, class members make claims on the pot of money, and it's distributed pro rata.
Now on the 26F statement, you say the false statement or misleading statement is that there was no mention of the fact that a settlement had been tentatively reached.
It was that the court said that was misleading, yes.
Well, what's your position about that?
I think they were very lucky that the court found that it wasn't in bad faith. That's a pretty extraordinary thing to leave out when you're telling the court we think we're going to trial in 2016, that you've
and
already reached.
Where do we go in the record to find that there was a settlement by that point?
That's in the district court's opinion itself, I think addendum 2, pages 2 and 3. It sets out the sequence that the settlement in principle is reached March 31st, and nobody disputes that. The Rule 26F statement was filed in April, and then they dismissed in June.
So is that in the court's order, the 26F? Don't lose Judge Shepherd's question. I'm just looking here. Is 26F in the judge's order?
He discusses the 26F order and then eventually makes – he initially criticizes it in the first decision and then retracts the finding that it was bad faith to do that and just says it's misleading.
And where did the district court get the information upon which it based this finding that – by March 31st, the settlement had been reached?
The parties acknowledged that.
So you just say that's undisputed.
That's not disputed.
By March 31st, settlement had been reached, but it was not mentioned or alluded to in the 26F statement, and when you read it, it appears that the matter is still in dispute and proceeding apace to trial.
That's correct, and the court at page 45, I think it was, criticizes the lack of candor. And I think it's important to recognize that district courts are used to adversary proceedings. They're not set up to be ex parte investigators. And they don't have experience in that. They're not trained for that. And when a settlement happens in a class action context, it switches from an adversary proceeding to what's effectively an ex parte proceeding, with the two parties coming to the court and telling them, here's what you should do, here's what's going to happen. And in every other context of the law, when we have an ex parte proceeding, we require enormous duties of candor and good faith dealings with the deciding body, precisely because it's ex parte and absent parties who might be prejudiced or the public interest that might be prejudiced doesn't have a chance to respond. In a patent proceeding, if you make the kind of omission that happens here, the patent can be invalidated for inequitable conduct. And so that all that happened here is the court saying it's improper to engage in forum shopping, to prejudice absent class members. It didn't use the words fiduciary duty, but if you look at what it's describing in page 34, that's the very definition of a breach of fiduciary duty. And that's an 11B1 problem.
Okay, so what you just described there is the basis of the court's, the reasons for the court's findings here. I'm not relating that. I'm having trouble relating that to this alleged misleading statement or false statement. Does that really have anything to do with this matter, or is it just interesting information about how the case developed?
Well, I think it goes to show the bad faith in that the parties knew that they were going to get an adverse ruling. They knew the judge would be upset at this settlement. And they actually did mislead the court about whether there was a settlement of this sort. And the court only learned about it by reading about it in the newspaper.
Now, I found the 26F part of the judge's order, I think. And if I understand, the judge did not use the 26F report for any bad faith at all.
That's correct.
Okay.
He just made a finding that it was misleading. And while he initially said it was bad faith, he retracted that in the final order at 45. I think it informs what happened. This was not a case where they go to the court and say, here's our colorable argument for how we interpret Rule 23 and what we're allowed to do. And we're letting you know that this is what we're doing, and we're doing it. They hid it from the judge, and if there hadn't been a newspaper article, nothing would have happened. The judge never would have learned about it. There would have been an administrative dismissal, and the class would have been prejudiced with a settlement that paid the attorney six times as much as the class.
Well, if the parties had disclosed to the judge the situation, you've got a situation where you have a case that's developing, but there's not been a certification of the class. And let's say the parties approach the judge and say, Judge, we've reached a settlement, and we want to stipulate a dismissal. What in your mind, what would the judge or the court have done in that situation here?
I'm
trying to figure out how the judge envisioned this proceeding in a more proper way in this matter.
I think the judge could have issued orders protecting its jurisdiction. I think the judge could have issued findings about the settlement that had been reached. I think the judge could have said, if you do this, I'm going to sanction you because you're doing this to evade judicial review and evade the Class Action Fairness Act and to prejudice absent class members.
And are there cases, is there authority that maybe you have cited that give us examples of courts intervening prior to certification of a class to prevent a stipulated dismissal?
Well, there are district courts that issue orders that say if you settle, these are things you're not going to include in your settle. So, for example, Judge Alsup in the Northern District of California issues an order that says no clear sailing in my court, no kicker arrangements in my court, and if you're going to have a claims-made settlement, you better have a good reason. Courts obviously have a wide range of differences in protection, and some just let these things go through, and the parties do cite several cases.
Well, let me tell
you
what really what concerns me about this, and maybe you can help or at least give your view. If you have a rule, as we do here, that permits parties to stipulate to dismissal and really without the court's participation, and entitles the party to dismiss the case, and as was done here, the court's not even involved. The clerk's office enters the order, and it's a rule that's clearly set forth.
Mm-hmm.
How can the court then, if that rule is there and that action is permitted under the rule, how can the court find bad faith on the part of counsel? Isn't there at least enough question or lack of certainty that counsel has some is protected in that situation?
I have two answers to that. One, if this was under 11b2, that's absolutely correct, and that would be a slam dunk. 11b2 sanctions are absolutely inappropriate here. What the court found was an 11b1 improper purpose. Again, you can do something that's non-frivolous and entirely permissible under the rules and still have an improper purpose. So, and we cite examples in our brief, and there's the Mars Steel decision. And even in the context of dismissal, Gardner, the case that they cite, says, you know, and it would be different if this was a class action, because then you might be prejudicing absent class members. The second part of my answer to that is I absolutely understand the argument that, you know, somebody had to be the first one to find that this was improper, and it was this judge and these people were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I think that is the strongest argument that they have, that, well, maybe this is improper, but
briefly, we've got a couple minutes left. Would you address the appellant's argument that this case involves our delineating a standard for evaluation of attorney's conduct? What would you propose that standard to be?
Well, acting for an improper purpose where the court finds what's effectively a breach of fiduciary duty, I think is within the scope of 11b1. Now, if the argument is this is a case of first impression and we're effectively being blindsided here because it's a case of first impression, that's an argument for saying a reprimand is too harsh, but it's not an argument for saying that this isn't improper and that future parties that do this, now that this opinion is out there, will be sanctioned for doing it. And that's a fallback position we acknowledge in our brief. I do want to go to the page either 39 or 40 necessitates language where the court says if the parties are right, that would necessitate an evaluation of Rule 11. And I think the parties are taking it out of context, because what the judge was saying there is the fact that there's this interpretation of Rule 23E that doesn't make it proper, you know, that makes it non-frivolous. But that doesn't make it proper. There's nothing in the Rule 23 amendment that says you get to prejudice absent class members with a dismissal. Admittedly, we went from one ambiguous Rule 23E to another ambiguous Rule 23E. Under the old Rule 23E, courts were sitting there and evaluating whether it was okay to dismiss a case when it was only affecting the class representative. And the new rule doesn't explicitly acknowledge the problem of what happens when the dismissal is made to prejudice absent class members, as the district court found here and as nobody challenges that finding. I acknowledge that the rule is unfortunately ambiguous on that. On the other hand, you can absolutely do something that's non-frivolous and permitted by the rules, but do it for an improper purpose, and that permits Rule 11b1 sanctions.
Isn't implicit in your argument today that the contention that the Arkansas state courts are not as willing or as capable of protecting class members or putative class members as are the federal courts?
The rules are absolutely different, and the court made a finding, which again is not challenged and even acknowledged here, that this was meant to defer good faith objectors who had a reason to object to the settlement. But the district court expressly stated that the federal district court in this case would not have approved this settlement.
Isn't there something wrong with that kind of that assumption that the federal courts have a better way, and that the state courts are not capable of protecting the interests?
I would not say that the state courts are not capable of protecting the interests. I would say that it's unambiguously clear, and they stated that this was the reason that they engaged in the forum shopping, that they provide less protections for class members, and that the forum shopping was done to prejudice, to disadvantage the absent class members. That's a factual finding that's not being challenged.
Thank you, Mr. Frank.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Joseph, we'll give you a minute. I think you had about 50
seconds. Thank you, Your Honors. First, it was entirely deceptive to suggest that my clients didn't inform the court of the settlement before the Rule 26F report. On March 26th, they advised the court they'd reached settlement on all material terms. It's pages 64 to 67 of the appendix, and asked for a stay. The judge said file the 26F. If they didn't file the 26F, they would have been subject to sanction under Rule 16F, so they filed the 26F, and the court withdrew 26F as any improper purpose at page 31 of the addendum. The court withdrew the statements to the state court as anything misleading at page 37 of the addendum. Everything he's suggesting for bad faith is false. The only finding of bad faith was knowing Thatcher and Ham and still filing the dismissal, even though Thatcher and Ham had never been applied to a dismissal, and even though 26E permitted the dismissal. And this distinction that counsel's trying to draw between doing non-frivolous things but for an improper purpose, people don't sue each other because they love them. And what this court said in Wolfchild, which was dealing with bad faith because it was an inherent power sanction, sanctions are not appropriate where the plaintiffs had colorable legal arguments. My clients not only had colorable legal arguments, they acted honorably through this, and what we just heard I can't respond to, but our brief, I think, addresses the issues. Thank you, Your Honors.
The court wishes to thank counsel for both sides here for your presence in the argument and for the briefing which you've provided us. We will take the case under advisement, render decision in due course. Thank you.
Thank you.